honored to be invited, and thank you for the kind words, Jeremy. I don't want to spend too long in the chit-chat and proceed to the talk, because I think it'll take the full hour. But I do want to say, what a wonderful group of people you are. It moves me to be invited by you. One can feel your friendship for each other, and your love of learning in a short distance. In Fides et Ratio, John Paul, soon to be Saint John Paul, mentions the kinship between friendship and philosophy as deep and permanent, going all the way back to the birth of philosophy in the Greeks. I think you all show it. So, without further ado, Lincoln's speech on the repeal of the Missouri Compromise and the propriety of its rhetoric constitute the subject of what I am about to say. In order to defend the propriety, the wisdom, even, of that speech, I must first say something about rhetoric, and political rhetoric in particular. I will take Plato as my authority and his Gorgias as my principal text. The first impression one gets from that dialogue is that it is directed against rhetoric, and especially the rhetoric one finds in political speeches. It even seems directed against politics, or at any rate the democratic politics such as one finds in the Athenian polity. This is the first look at the text. But there are signs and hints of something more, something from the first page to the last. Let me show you a few, and then I'll tell you what I think the implied meaning, the second look, appears to me to be. I need Bibles now, so I'll put this a little closer. Socrates and his longtime companion, Chaerephon, meet up with Callicles, a young and ambitious Athenian, just outside Callicles' house. Inside are Gorgias, an old and distinguished teacher of rhetoric, a celebrity almost, and his student, Polus. Callicles speaks first, adapting a proverb you will recognize from Shakespeare's use of it in Henry IV, Part 1. To the latter end of a fray and the beginning of a feast fits a dull fighter and a keen guest. So here is the opening of the Gorgias, Callicles. In war and battle, Socrates, this is the way to do your part. Socrates. Oh my, did we show up too late after the feast? As the saying goes. Socrates says they did, since Gorgias has just finished making a display of many beautiful things, the Feast of Words. And Socrates blames Chaerephon for delaying the two of them in the Agora. Chaerephon accepts the blame, but promises to cure the evil, not the metaphor, cure, by appealing to Gorgias' friendship with him. Socrates asked Gorgias, asked if Gorgias would be willing to converse with them, setting aside any display, and he reveals what he wants to converse about. What power belongs to the man's art, and what it is that he lays claim to and teaches. Callicles boldly invites Socrates to come in and do just that, an invitation that Socrates calls beautiful. And then, oddly, sends Chaerephon in first with the injunction, you ask him. Chaerephon, timidly, or perhaps a little dull, responds, ask him what? Socrates, who is he? Chaerephon, again hesitating, how do you mean? Socrates responds with one of his characteristic comparisons to arts and artisans. This time, shoemaking and the shoemaker. It would seem that Chaerephon is to ask Gorgias about his art, Are we to think that the questions, who are you, and what is your art, and what is the power of your art, are all the same? Does the answer to one throw light on the others? What do you think? When Chaerephon, somewhat artlessly, tries to ask Gorgias this, Polus barges in even before Chaerephon can get to the correct framing of the question. Polus says he will answer for Gorgias, perhaps because he too wishes to make a display. The way Chaerephon questions Polus only increases our perplexity about the meanings of, who are you? In his question, he names individuals, not by arts, but by family relations. The first, Herodicus, happens to be Gorgias' brother, and also to be a doctor. Who is he? A brother or a doctor? Chaerephon asks Polus the leading question. If Gorgias happened to be a knower of his brother's art, what would we justly name him? Wouldn't it be what that one, Herodicus, is named? The answer, to which Polus agrees, is this. In asserting that he is a doctor, then, we would be saying something fine. Polus, at least, is willing to take a man as defined by his art. This is the second mention of medicine, let us notice. Chaerephon, after I noticed such example, a painter this time, tries to get Polus to name Gorgias by his art. He is met with a blast of bombast about how Gorgias' art is the most beautiful. At this point, Socrates steps in for his follower Chaerephon, and Gorgias replaces Polus. And we step back for some perspective. You, who have read the dialogue, were you struck by the frequent use of medicine, health, and doctors in Socrates' examples? I was, and so I began to count them. I came up with over 20, from Chaerephon's brief and casual mention of having the cure, as I mentioned at the beginning, and the mere fact of Gorgias having a doctor for a brother, through many longer passages, and including the well-known analogy he produces for Polus, which is in brief this, cookery is to medicine as rhetoric is to justice, which would make rhetoric a species of flattery. Gorgias mentions his own use of rhetoric to help a sick person accept his brother the physician's advice. He imagines the somewhat fantastic case of a deliberative assembly taking the advice of a rhetorician over that of a doctor on some matter of health concerning the public. And yet, is that perhaps so fantastic? Remember Pericles' policy of retreat within the walls of the Peloponnesian War and the ensuing plague? Finally, I count 6 passages, some brief and others extended, where Socrates uses health and sickness of soul, and often the doctor, in his encounter with Callicles, the longest and concluding section of the text. I suggest that medicine is not merely a convenient example for the Gorgias, it is a thematic example. Let us leave the text again and think on our own for a bit. First about arts and identity. Who are you? Who am I? I'm a tutor at Thomas Aquinas College. Perhaps I have an art by which I do that. I teach many things, and each may be called an art, one of the liberal arts. Am I a kind of kentaur composed of many characters? More, I'm a Catholic, an American citizen, a son, father, and husband. Who am I? Do you think these questions are modern and do violence to Plato's thought? If so, consider this from the Phaedrus. This is Socrates speaking. For me, the question is whether I happen to be some sort of beast, even more complex in form and more tumultuous than the 100-headed Typhon, or whether I am something simpler and gentler, having by nature a share of the divine and the untyphonic. To have a share of the divine is to partake in integrity, in wholeness. In our time, we tend to call some artful activities, the ones by which we make a living, medicine, or teaching, for example, professions, and others mere jobs. Why is that? Is it not because the professions, in various degrees, engage and perfect the person by having a greater wholeness, an element of wisdom, however imperfect? Could rhetoric be such an art? An art that contains a share of wholeness, a kind of wisdom? The answer, the simple answer to the question, who are you, in Gorgias' case, will be given by Gorgias himself once Polus and Chaerephon hand the argument back to their teachers. He declares to Socrates that he is a knower of the art of rhetoric, and a good one too. He adds that he can make others into the same. In other words, he can teach his art, and for men living in any polity, Athens, but not Athens only. Rhetoric effects persuasion, and Socrates leads Gorgias through a maze of important questions about whether it is universal or limited to persuasion about some things only. Since our interest tonight is in political rhetoric, we will pass by these texts with regret. And in fact, I propose to rush ahead to the most interesting part of the dialogue for our purposes, the crisis that marks the end of the portion where Gorgias is Socrates' main interlocutor, a section that is marked by earnestness, courtesy, and energy on Socrates' part. It is also a crisis that is not resolved because of a violent intervention by Polus. This is how the crisis is reached. Gorgias agrees that his art is for speaking persuasively to crowds, courts, and legislative assemblies about the just and the unjust. He has also said that he can teach others what he knows, and that his students must be just already, or if not, he can teach them that too. Rhetoric is taken to include justice, and Gorgias has claimed to be the exemplar teacher of rhetoric. Gorgias goes on to agree that anyone who has learned justice becomes just, but he has also said that he, the teacher, is not responsible if his student uses rhetoric unjustly, and whoever acts unjustly is, at least in that instance, not just. Now let me quote this at length so we may see just how it unfolds in the text. Socrates. But for now, let's examine this first. Is the rhetorician in exactly the same condition with respect to the just and the unjust, the beautiful and the shameful, the good and the bad, as he is with respect to the healthy and the other matters belonging to the other arts, that he doesn't know them, what's good or bad, what's beautiful, or what's shameful, or just, or unjust, but contrives persuasion about them, so that without knowing, he seems among those who don't know, to know more than the one who does know. Socrates still. Or is it a necessity that he know them? And does the person who's going to learn rhetoric from you have to arrive knowing these things already? And if the one who arrives doesn't know them, are you, the teacher of rhetoric, going to teach him nothing about these things? Because it's not your job. And are you going to make him seem among the masses to know such things when he doesn't know them, and seem to be good when he isn't? Or will you be totally unable to teach him rhetoric if he doesn't already know the truth about these things? How does it go with things like that, Gorgias? And in front of Zeus, make the revelation you were just now saying you would, and tell us what in the world the power of rhetoric is. Note the invocation of Zeus here. The matter is serious, and it pertains to the power of rhetoric. And here's Gorgias in response. Well, I suppose, Socrates, if he doesn't happen to know these things, he'll learn them from me too. And Socrates, hold it right there. Because you're putting it beautifully. If you make someone a rhetorician, it's a necessity for him to know the things that are just and unjust, either beforehand or afterwards, by learning them from you. Socrates emphasizes this agreement and says Gorgias speaks beautifully here. The Greek could also mean finely or even nobly. Note that he praises Gorgias. Does he flatter him? However that may be, he's kind. Gorgias. Quite so. Socrates. What about this? Someone who's learned matters of carpentry is a carpenter, is he not? Yes. And someone who's learned matters of music is a musician. Yes. And someone who's learned matters of doctoring is a doctor. And so on for the rest. According to our same speech, each one who's learned each thing is the sort of person his knowledge turns him into. We know the example of the doctor is the climax of this list of arts making the man. Gorgias. Quite so. So according to our same speech, it's also the case that someone who's learned matters of justice is just. Totally so. And presumably the just person does just things. Then it's a necessity that the rhetorician is just, and that a just person wants to do just things. So it appears. Therefore, the just person will never want to do injustice, necessarily. And from our speech, it's a necessity that the rhetorician is just. Yes. Therefore, the rhetorician will never want to do injustice. It appears not, anyway. Well, I think the dialogues are hilarious. The combination of deeply serious and just hilarious. Well, this is Socrates now. Do you remember saying a little while ago that one ought not to lay blame on the trainers or throw them out of the cities, that these are boxing trainers? If a boxer uses his boxing skill and commits injustice, and so in the same way if a rhetorician uses his rhetorical skill unjustly, one ought not to lay the blame on the person who taught him or exile him from the city, but the person who's doing the injustice and isn't using his rhetoric rightly. Were those things said or not? Well, they were said. But now it's shown that this same person, the rhetorician, never does injustice. Isn't that so? So it appears. And in the first speeches that were made, Gorgias, it was said that rhetoric would be about speeches not on the odd and the even, but on the just and the unjust. Is that right? Yeah. So in view of that, when you said those things then, I assumed that rhetoric, which always makes speeches about justice, could never be an unjust thing. But since you were saying a little later that the rhetorician might also use his rhetoric unjustly, I got so surprised, thinking the things that had been said weren't in harmony, that I made those statements to the effect that if you would count it a gain to be refuted the way I would, and it'd be worthwhile to have a conversation, but, well, if not, to tell it goodbye. And now, further along, when we've examined it, you see for yourself that we agree once again that the rhetorician is incapable of using his rhetoric unjustly, or of being willing to do injustice. What in the world is going on with these things, Gorgias? By the dog. My lander nosebleed has started again. Could somebody get me a glass of water? This will help. I will be able to speak, don't worry. Okay, unless you want me to stop. Might make a difference in my tone. They say you're supposed to stay erect. Thank you. Stay here and catch you. No, I'm not going to thank you. So, what in the world is going on with these things, Gorgias, by the dog, is something it will take no small communal effort to look into adequately from all angles. Now, at this point, Polus again breaks in, and we are left wondering where this serious conversation would have gone. Note the oath, by the dog, that Socrates employs here, and his earnest but friendly invitation to Gorgias, an invitation to think together. About the second of these, the communal effort, it is aborted by Polus' abrupt and rude interruption. From this point on, Gorgias, whose identity was to have been the central question, will remain completely silent, except to ask once for clarification of something that Socrates says, and once more much later to urge Callicles to let the discussion continue. In both cases, he asks. He makes no display and makes no claims. About the first, the oath, that's by the log. In Plato's writings, it signifies the Egyptian god Anubis, whose Greek counterpart is Hermes, the soul conductor. It's Hermes who takes Priam to Achilles' tent to recover the body of Hector, a scene that's reminiscent of the underground, the dead knight, and the tent contains a dead body, which he is bringing back. Eva Bram, St. John's tutor, has she visited you all? You should invite her. She's wonderful. And she's getting on in years. Eva Bram, a great living reader of Plato. I don't want to much. She's my teacher. In many things, my ultimate, suggests that Hermes, who was the guide of Heracles, famous for his 12 labors, may be understood as a guide in the greatest labor for men, the work of self-examination. Polus blocks that labor. There is more at stake here than the contradiction into which Gorgias has fallen, and it is not just the question of who the particular man Gorgias is. The underlying question is about political rhetoric and its relation to justice and its power and nature. A few pages later, in speaking with Polus about rhetoric, Socrates will call it an eidolon of justice, just as cookery is an eidolon of medicine. Well, don't worry, I'll translate that word. The word is, in this context, variously translated in the versions of the Gorgias I've been consulting as phantom, simulacrum, and since Socrates seems to be thinking of a mere image, a deceit, really. But there are images and images. Sometimes an eidolon can be, at least in part, a faithful image. The idols of the pagans, so the prophets tell us, are utterly false. In fact, there is no original of which they are likenesses. Homer has Odysseus reach out to embrace an eidolon in Hades, as does Virgil in Aeneas' Adventure Underground. These are phantoms, not real men and women, but they are idola of what were once real originals. And similar to these are the phantoms in our dreams. We are merely dreaming, most of them. But generally, they come from originals, the real persons and things of our waking life. We learn something about how we actually look as we gaze on our own reflections. Still other images, as man himself, are likenesses with some true participation in the being of their originals. We are created, as Genesis says, in the image and likeness of God himself. Granting that in his speech to Polus, Socrates intended the meaning of deceitful image, we may wonder whether for Polus, who at this point is fed, for Gorgias, I'm sorry, who at this point is intently listening, the richer, more truth-like senses come to mind. And if we are listening intently, we too may and should ask that question. I propose that this very possibility is just what Socrates wanted to investigate by the talk when Polus aborted the conversation. And it is just for this reason that he has treated Gorgias throughout his discussion with him so respectfully. There may be a true rhetoric, and Gorgias, though without full self-knowledge, may have a sense of it, though through a glass darkly. Let me put that more directly as my first conclusion. There is such a thing as good rhetoric. It demands justice and truth on the part of the rhetorician. If he is a political rhetorician, it requires knowledge of political justice. It will not be like cookery, but like medicine. It will aim at healing the body politic, at least where that body is seriously ill. Having as its goal the good of the other, it may truly be said to partake of charity. It acts from goodwill, even charity, for the patient. The answer to the question, who are you, Gorgias? What is your art and its power? Could be, I am a statesman, or one with the skill of a statesman. My art is helping the political community get well, and its power is vast, not infinite, but vast. And my job is worthy of being called a profession, or at least a part of a profession, since it aims at something high and whole. Now we turn very briefly to the final part of the dialogue, where something like this view is stated directly by the most hostile Socrates interlocutors, Callicles. And where this view seems harshly rejected by Socrates, I give a sketch of the text. Socrates, provocative as always, now brings the now bitter discussion. One may want to even call it a discussion at this point. I don't know if you recall the violence of the and contentiousness of the discussion between Socrates and Callicles at the end of the dialogue. It's one of the most bitter exchanges in the Platonic dialogues. Socrates brings the discussion back to political rhetoric. In the background for some time has been the sharp distinction, too sharp, between pleasing one's hearers like a cook or benefiting them like a doctor. This is what Socrates asks this of Callicles. What about the rhetoric directed to the Athenian populace or to the other populations of free men in the cities? What in the world do we make of that? Do rhetoricians seem to you to be speaking always with a view to what's best, aiming at that with their speeches, so the citizens will be the best they can possibly be? Or do they too exert themselves towards gratifying the citizens and place a low value on the common things for the sake of their own private interests? Talking to the populace like they were children, trying only to gratify them without giving any thought to whether they'll be better or worse from that. Callicles very interestingly answers thus. It's not a bitter answer, it's thoughtful. This is no longer a simple question you're asking, because there are some who say the things they say out of care for the citizens, and some who are the sort you're speaking of. In what follows, Socrates first elicits from Callicles the confession that there are no such rhetoricians. None in our time. None. I wonder how many of you would be tempted to give that response to him. In what follows, Socrates first elicits from Callicles that, and then they turn to the ancients, famous men, Themistocles, Pericles. And Socrates too harshly, at least in my opinion, claims that none of them passes muster. Callicles demurs. Let us note this. If any rhetorician or statesman did make the people better, more law-abiding, more moderate and just, more complete as human beings, he would pass this test. My own opinion is that Socrates is too puritanical here, too insensitive to the goods of liberty, commerce, and progress. He's thinking of the Athena. Athens in the age of Pericles and the Peloponnesian War, the glorious Athens, the city on the hill, with its temple on the hill. So, I'll repeat that then. My own opinion is that Socrates is too puritanical, too insensitive to the goods of liberty, commerce, and progress to see how the statesman who gave Athens its hegemony did in fact make the people, at least in some ways, more perfect in the possibilities of human life. I stand with Pericles on this question. I do not propose here to argue that position. We might want to think about it in the question period. Now, I wish to bring in very quickly two more ancient opinions, one from Plato and another from St. Augustine. After that, we leave antiquity in the Mediterranean and move on to the American Midwest of the 19th century. Plato treats of dialogue at some length in another dialogue, the Phaedrus. The topic is embedded in a very rich, apparently ununified discussion of love, the soul, writing versus speech, and dialectic. I confess right off the bat that I will be taking things out of context and interpreting them almost aphoristically with little explicit justification. What I see. What? This is supposed to be the first time I was like that. What I say here is as much my opinion as that of Plato. He provokes me to think most of what I am about to say. So, in this dialogue, Socrates compares rhetoric to medicine again. If this comparison is valid, the rhetorician, like the physician, must know something. The doctor knows the body. And in particular, he must know the body of this particular person whom he will heal. He diagnoses him, as we say. Persuasion in general demands knowing the soul of the listener. Moreover, all rhetoric, at least in the Phaedrus, is called psychagogia, soul leading or soul conduction. Socrates says this, since the capacity of speech is to guide the soul, someone intending to become a rhetorician must know what forms the soul possesses. Phaedrus says, it is not possible to describe it otherwise, Socrates, I suppose. Yet this seems to be no small undertaking. Okay. I say, good political rhetoric, the rhetoric of the statesman, knows the soul. This will be, if such a thing is possible, the soul of the body politic. Political diagnosis would mean knowing what is wrong with this particular polity and what health means for it. On the authority of St. Augustine, I wish you to grant me that there is such a thing as the soul of a political community. Indeed, that this is what actually makes of a mere multitude a res publica, or a people. Here is St. Augustine. Suppose that we were to define what it means to be a people, not in the usual way, but in a different fashion, such as the following. The people is a multitudinous assemblage of rational beings united by concord regarding loved things held in common. Then, if we wished to discern the character of any given people, we would have to investigate what it loves. If it is a multitudinous assemblage not of cattle, but of rational creatures, and if these are united by concord regarding loved things held in common, then it is not absurd to call it a people. And its estate, race, is without doubt a commonwealth, res publica. What this people loved, then speaking of the Romans, what this people, the Romans, loved in early times, and what it loved in the ages that followed, the practices by which it passed into bloody sedition, and then into social and civil wars, tearing apart and destroying that concord, which is, in a certain manner, the health and welfare, the Latinary solids, of a people. To this history bears witness. And what I have said concerning this people, Romans, and concerning its commonwealth, this also I should be understood to have said and thought concerning the Athenians, the rest of the Greeks, and the other nations as well. To apply this to our own republic, let us listen to John Quincy Adams in his magnificent speech on the 50th anniversary of the ratification of the Constitution, a speech much too little known. Someone is smiling at me there. This is just part of it. It's a huge speech. The Constitution's virtues, its republican character, consisted in its conformity to the principles proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence. And as its administration must necessarily be always pliable to the fluctuating varieties of public opinion, its stability and duration in the hearts and minds of the people, its stability and duration by a like overruling and irresistible necessity was to depend on the stability and duration in the hearts and minds of the people of that virtue, or in other words, of those principles proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence and embodied in the Constitution of the United States. Now, on to Peoria, 1854. In 1859, Abraham Lincoln was seeking the Republican Party's nomination as its presidential candidate. He described his political career in these words. This is the world's most elegant and shortest campaign biography. In 1864, I was once elected to the lower house of Congress. I was not a candidate for re-election. From 1849 to 1854, both inclusive, practiced law more assiduously than ever before. Always a Whig in politics, and generally on the Whig electoral tickets, making active canvasses. I was losing interest in politics when the repeal of the Missouri Compromise aroused me again. What I have done since then is pretty well known. The Missouri Compromise was a portion of the act establishing the Kansas and Nebraska territories. This bill, the Nebraska Act, overturned the federal ban on slavery in that part of the Louisiana Purchase north of 36 degrees 30 minutes. Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois was then the chairman of the Senate Committee on Territories. Douglas consented to the amendment and the bill passed. And as Douglas predicted, a hell of a storm arose. What did Douglas intend? There can be no doubt that he wanted the Union to survive and prosper. Moreover, he was not like Calhoun of the slavery as a positive good school. Indeed, Douglas had supported the admission of California as a free state and the organization of the Oregon Territory, in which Congress adopted an amendment offered by Douglas, recognizing the existing ban on slavery enacted by the settlers themselves. Douglas was an intelligent and bold politician, ambitious for the presidency. He would be the candidate of the Northern Democrats in 1860 running against Lincoln. He saw the threat of disunion and had heard the resentment in his Southern Democratic colleagues like Calhoun. Calhoun had all but demanded that no one even talk about slavery as a political question. These are Calhoun's exact words from his speech of March 4, 1850. The North has only to will it, this is the saving of the Union, to accomplish it, to do justice by conceding to the South an equal right in the acquired territory, that means the right to have slavery there, and to do her duty by causing the stipulations relative to the fugitive slaves to be faithfully fulfilled, to cease the agitation of the saved slavery question, that is to say nothing more about it. Take it out of politics. Some people say that about abortion. That's just not a properly political question. Ought not to be discussed. Too divisive. Calhoun died on the last day of that same month. He'd been too sick to read his own speech to the Senate, and so had it read for him by a friend. But in the 4 years since the compromise measures had passed, the agitation had not ceased. It was a time for new efforts by younger statesmen, and Douglas sought to be that statesman. He proposed and oversaw the passage of a bold answer to the Union's troubles. This was the Nebraska Act of 1854. It combined practical politics and principle. He called the principle popular sovereignty. Let us hear Douglas from his 1858 speech given in Chicago. This will be the kickoff speech for the Senate campaign against Lincoln. So here's Douglas. I regard the great principle of popular sovereignty as having been vindicated and made triumphant in this land as a permanent rule of public policy in the organization of territories and the admission of new states. I deny Congress right to force a good thing upon a people who are unwilling to receive it. The great principle is the right of every community to judge and decide of itself whether a thing is right or wrong, whether it be good or evil for them to adopt it. And the right of free action, the right of free thought, the right of free judgment upon the question is dearer to every true American than any other under a free government. As a policy, popular sovereignty meant that Congress would no longer prohibit slavery in any United States territory. The question would be handed over to the people of the territories as they organized themselves. It would be addressed again in their conventions when they grew ripe for statehood. Since the fugitive slave law was now in effect, and since the overseas slave trade had been illegal for nearly 50 years, this meant that there should be no reason for any discussion or agitation on the issue to arise in Congress again, ever. He further promised not to care about what the people of these territories seeking admission had decided on the issue in preparing for admission as a state, so long as they had done it fairly. This was meant to satisfy the demands of what Lincoln referred to as the slave power. The national argument as a political argument was to cease, because, as some say now about abortion, the issue didn't belong in politics. But on the question of the spread of slavery, Douglas' solution had some appeal in the North, since many who had no love for slavery thought it unlikely that the northern climate would be hospitable to the plantation agriculture, chiefly cotton and rice, that had been home to slavery in the South. If this hunch about the economics of the spread of slavery were true, then the Union would become progressively more and more dominated by free states without anyone having to raise the question of the morality of slavery and thereby offending the slave interest in the South. To make all this work, Douglas had to persuade his fellow Americans that popular sovereignty was the cornerstone of the Republic. He had some reason to think it was, and that he could make a majority think so too. For one thing, the principle squared with the American fondness for local control. Douglas would point out in his 1858 debates with Lincoln that liquor laws and agricultural laws and a host of other ordinances differed from Maine to Louisiana, and that we liked it that way. Jefferson himself had been a strong proponent of states' rights and local self-government. At the same time, within these local communities, the will of the people had been held sovereign. Jefferson had called the rule of the will of the majority a sacred principle in his first inaugural address. But there were problems with Douglas' formulation. He might say, I don't care about local decisions on slavery, but people did care. In the case of Kansas, they would care enough to send armed bodies of settlers to inflate the votes of their side in the territorial disputes on the way to statehood. These men cared enough to shed blood over the question. And it was not perfectly evident that slavery could only prove profitable growing cash crops in warm climates. As Douglas uttered these words, there was in Richmond a successful factory enterprise that employed slave labor exclusively. Moreover, or most important, popular sovereignty in its fundamental sense, majority rule, is not a complete statement of the American creed. Jefferson's exact words from his first inaugural, in which he called the popular will sacred, deserve quotation in full. All too will bear in mind, this is Jefferson now, this sacred principle, that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will to be rightful must be reasonable, and that the majority possess their equal rights, which equal law must protect, and to violate would be oppression. Douglas' policy and that of the founders were alike in key points, but different in others. Both thought that the preservation of the Union was paramount. Both agreed in refusing to interfere with slavery where it existed. Both looked to a change to be produced by time and patience. But the founders had used the power of Congress in the Northwest Ordinance to block the expansion of slavery and to strengthen the conviction that it was wrong. Douglas looked to popular sovereignty to produce the first effect, while he took affirmative action to see that the second, the conviction that it was wrong, would not be expressed in the public arena. This meant that he differed from the founders in principle, not only in policy. Douglas had made self-rule by some men, and not self-evident truths concerning the natural rights of all, the deepest principle of free government. Lincoln, thought the policy harmful. He was convinced that the principle, as Douglas' understanding would have it, was false, but that puts it too mildly. He thought that the soul of the Republic, its unifying love, the very source of its life, was being poisoned by Douglas' error. That is what aroused him in 1854. Here is how he put it at Peoria. The doctrine of self-government is right, absolutely and eternally right, but it has no just application as here attempted. Or perhaps I should rather say that whether it has such an application depends on whether the Negro is not or is a man. If he is not a man, why in that case he who is a man may, as a matter of self-government, do just as he pleases with him. But if the Negro is a man, is it not to just that extent a total destruction of self-government to say that he too shall not govern himself? When the white man governs himself, that is self-government. But when he governs himself and also governs another man, that is more than self-government. That is desperation. If the Negro is a man, why then, my ancient faith teaches me that all men are created equal, and that there can be no moral right in connection with one man's making a slave of another. Judge Douglas frequently and with bitter irony and sarcasm paraphrases our argument by saying, the white people of Virginia are good, of Nebraska are good enough to govern themselves, but they are not good enough to govern a few miserable Negroes. Well, I doubt not that the people of Nebraska are, and will continue to be, as good as the average of people elsewhere. I do not say the contrary. What I do say is that no man is good enough to govern another man without that other's consent. I say that this is the leading principle, the sheet anchor of American republicanism. Lincoln's Peoria speech merits our attention for many historical reasons. It puts clearly and briefly the story of federal power over slavery over a period of 7 decades. It gives the heart of his disagreement with Douglas, and it put Lincoln on the path to the White House. But I wish to present it as a model of American Socratic rhetoric. Lincoln gave essentially the same speech at least 4 times, writing out the second, the one given in Peoria, for publication in the Illinois State Journal. Lincoln had asked Douglas to have the Peoria event be a debate. Douglas told a friend he didn't want to debate Lincoln, saying, he is the most difficult and dangerous opponent that I have ever met. Instead of holding a debate, they spoke one after another to the same crowd, Douglas going first. Lincoln's shrewd political sense manifested itself in the timing. Douglas had spoken early in the afternoon. He told the tired crowd to go have dinner and come back before hearing him. Douglas had worn them out with a 3-hour retreat on a warm afternoon. To make sure they returned, he also offered Douglas an hour's rebuttal to skin me. He was great at country corn pone stuff. He was really good at it. The opening sentence of the subject gives the subject of the speech in plain homespun simplicity. The repeal of the Missouri Compromise and the propriety of its restoration constitute the subject to what I am about to say. The first quarter or so is a thorough and dispassionate review of the policy of Congress regarding slavery from the time of the Articles of Confederation down to the present day. It establishes conclusively that Congresses from before the Constitution up to the 1850s held that they had the power to restrict slavery in the national territories, and had often used that power. In thinking of the requirements of true rhetoric, we recall first its truthfulness. Lincoln's summary of the legal history of slavery in the territories is carefully researched and accurate. Its tone is mild and nonpartisan. It does justice to the motives of all the actors. And finally, by delaying any hortatory moments to the ending sections, It prepares for drama and finality. Passion, such as it occurs, comes after argument. His listeners will only be asked to feel after they have understood. The heart of the speech is Lincoln's treatment of the contradiction between popular sovereignty as applied to slavery and natural right as enshrined in the Declaration. If anyone, black, white, yellow, or brown, is a man, and if I arrogate to myself and to men of my race only the right to choose whether that man and his kind shall be slaves or not, I cannot have grounded that decision in the universal proposition that all men are created equal, and hence endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Since I am no longer measured, that is, held to a moral measure, in my choice, how shall I make it? Douglass' understanding of popular sovereignty comes to saying that the sacred right of self-government allows a moral right in one man's enslaving another. Lincoln says that the real meaning of Douglass' doctrine would lead men into an open war with the very principles of civil liberty, criticizing the Declaration of Independence and insisting that there is no right principle of action but self-interest. Indeed, not only would the popular sovereignty basis of the Nebraska Bill lead men to disparage the Declaration, it had already done so, and not only by the chieftains of the slave power like Calhoun. The eloquence of the following passage from the Peoria speech demands that it be quoted at length. Little by little, but steadily as men march to the grave, we have been giving up the old for the new faith. Nearly 80 years ago, we began by declaring that all men are created equal. But now, from that beginning, we have run down to the other declaration, that for some men to enslave others is a sacred right of self-government. These principles cannot stand together. They are as opposite as God and mammon, and whoever holds to the one must despise the other. When Pettus, who's a senator from Indiana, not from the South, in connection with his support of the Nebraska Bill, called the Declaration of Independence a self-evident lie, he only did what consistency and candor require all other Nebraska men to do. Of the 40-odd Nebraska senators, Nebraska senator is not from Nebraska. He's one of those who voted for the bill. Of the 40-odd Nebraska senators who sat present and heard him, no one rebuked him, nor am I apprised that any Nebraska newspaper or any Nebraska orator in the whole nation has ever yet rebuked him. If this had been said among Marion's men, Southerners though they were, what would have become of the man who said it? If this had been said to the men who captured Andre, the man who said it would probably have been hung sooner than Andre was. If it had been said in old Independence Hall 78 years ago, the very doorkeeper would have throttled the man and thrust him into the street. We know how well Lincoln knows his audience, or rather, I would rather say, how well he diagnoses his patient. Deep in the American soul lay three loves. Patriotism, especially for the Union declared in 1776 and achieved by the sword in the War of Independence. Hence the reference to Francis Marion Swamp Fox, the great revolutionary hero from South Carolina. And the Major Andre affair, which played out in the Northern Army, commanded by Washington. Two, this is the second love, the Declaration itself, hence the mention of old Independence Hall, the sacred temple of American liberty. And three, biblical religion, hence his invocation of the choice between God and mammon. Lincoln is here displaying his knowledge of the soul of the body politic in order to heal it. Sir Francis Bacon wrote long ago that nature to be mastered must be obeyed. The saying is equally true of the physical, of the nature of the physical body and of the body politic. Public opinion, the soul of the political body, was ailing in the days after the Nebraska Bill, and Douglas was prescribing as medicine what Lincoln thought poison. As we read the Peoria speech today, one element jars our sensibilities. Lincoln does not take a stand for full political and social equality of the races. Some of the abolitionists of his day, especially the Quakers and other religious abolitionists, did. The 1854 laws of Maine set up in almost all respects what we would recognize today as equal civil rights, including jury duty and voting rights. But Maine was almost alone. Illinois' laws did not allow blacks to vote or serve on juries. And Illinois was typical of the free states. In Peoria, Lincoln said this: "Let it not be said that I am contending for the establishment of social and political equality between the whites and blacks. I have already said the contrary." Was this statesmanlike too? Or was it either weak or unwise or even unjust? I think Lincoln's position in the Peoria speech is vindicated, and that it can be reconciled with his support for expanded civil rights towards the end of the Civil War, if two things are kept in mind. First, as Lincoln himself said, in this country, public opinion is everything. And second, that the knowledge of a statesman is prudence or practical wisdom, which consists in knowing how to move toward moral goals by practicable steps and not in the immoderate pursuit of moral perfection, which in the political life will more often lead to misery and terror than to justice and happiness. That last is a quotation from Tom West. To begin with the first point, is it not self-evident that in a republic where the citizens are governed by their consent, their opinion will be the court of last resort, the final arbiter of all disputes? That does not mean that those opinions will never change, or that it will not be the duty of a good man, and especially of a statesman, to mold them for the better. But a public man will ignore them at his peril. Lincoln turns this weapon back on Douglas in the Peoria speech when he tells him that he, Douglas, will never be able to suppress the voice of the people crying out that slavery is unjust. The great mass of mankind consider slavery a great moral wrong, and their feeling against it is not evanescent but eternal. It lies at the very foundation of their sense of justice, and it cannot be trifled with. It is a great and durable element of popular action, and I think no statesman can safely disregard it. Lincoln never said that political equality between the races was wrong. The most complete expression of his early views on the matter came in the 1858 debates with Douglas, and he clothed them entirely in the language of feeling. I'm quoting him now. "I said years ago, my own feelings would not admit social and political equality between the black and white races. And even if my own feelings would admit of it, I still knew that the public sentiment of the country would not, and that such a thing was an utter impossibility, or substantially that." End quote. And in the same debate, quote, "I agree with Judge Douglas that he, the Negro," not Douglas, "he, the Negro, is not my equal in many respects. Certainly not in color." Notice what a useless confession that is. It has the appearance of a confession. "Certainly not in color. Perhaps not in intellectual and moral endowments." A confession that's no confession. Perhaps. Maybe. Maybe not. Mm-hmm. but in the right to eat the bread without the leave of anybody else, which his own hand earns. He is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas and the equal of every other man. Now, I admit, in order to make you agree with my reading of this speech, I gave a certain emphasis to that passage. preaching, the political preaching of equality at that stage is dangerous in that time, is risky. And he faces the dragon in the much more vivid language of the ending of that section of the text than he does of the perhaps, I concede to you, straightness of hair or whatever. We don't have equality there. And then he not only says it of himself, which could sort of, other people don't have to agree with him, but then he looks right in the eye, and he says, and he's your equal. And the right to eat the bread that he's earned with the labor of his own body, he's your equal. And then he says, and of every other man looking out at the crowd. So that's powerful. That's powerful. And finally, in this 1858 debate, he made a reference to what he had said years ago. That's a reference to Peoria. It's a reference to our speech. And here's what he said there. Whether this feeling against equality, a feeling he had called it, accords with justice and sound judgment is not the sole question, if it indeed is any part of it. It's an extraordinarily interesting thing to say. As to whether it should be policy now, the question is not solely, and maybe not at all, whether it's in accord with justice and sound judgment. And then he adds that wisdom, I called it wisdom, going back to Francis Bacon, he adds this, a universal feeling, whether well or ill-founded, can not be safely disregarded. We cannot, then, make them equals. Notice it's not should not. Should or should not. We cannot. Now, I'm going to depart from my text and say a little something about what actually happened. As you know, Lincoln was elected, slave states seceded, particularly the first and most vigorously, those that had the greatest interest in slavery, the Deep South. From South Carolina through to Alabama, Louisiana, Texas. The war came. In the course of the war, it became evident that it was a plausibly constitutional and militarily highly advantageous and also advantageous in foreign policy to emancipate the slaves in the states that were then in rebellion, following a tradition of appropriation of property of combatants in war situations. They, as the Confederate held territory shrank, slaves liberated themselves and came towards the Union armies, and also areas fell under Union control, so the number of persons freed by the Emancipation Proclamation turned out to be huge. You will hear in contentious debate that it freed not one slave because it was ineffective. It was where the South had control, the Confederacy had control, and where the Union did, it was not proclaimed. It wasn't declared. But that's a tendentious and silly reading of the history. And a sign of it is that by the end of the war, there were somewhere between 150,000 and 200,000 freemen, black freemen, in the Union armies. Give you an idea how many men that is, the South is outnumbered in almost all the battles. Sometimes by a little, sometimes by a lot. On the Richmond front, the Army of the Potomac in the final year of the war, Grant versus Lee, that year, The whole army of the Potomac was 140,000 men. I mean, it was that many muskets and bayonets, and also mule drivers and cooks, and you know, it was an army. It was a full-sized army. It was like twice the size of Lee's army, that many. One of the things that did was establish the opinion that Lincoln made so much earlier in the speech that he's a man. That he's a man. Because he can show courage and risk his life. You know? Sometimes slaves were manumitted free in antiquity for deeds of virtue or show of courage in battle, among other things. So that the social question, the question of social and political equality, did become practical with great struggles following. I won't say much about the Reconstruction and the whole following 100 years. But, for example, the rights to serve on juries and vote by 1868 was universal. And whether it was well used and how the whole thing played out is a long, complicated story. But it was inconceivable in 1854, and it was factual in 1866. It was that sudden a change. So a feeling can be changed. I don't know how often it can be changed by a speech. In this case, it was changed by the witness of blood, by the display of courage. Courage. You all know your Latin better than I do. But it has something to do with manliness, I believe. Is he a man or not? He shows virtus. He's a man. Now, the conclusion. This is a slight bit repetitive of what I was just saying, but I departed my text because I wanted to think about that last with you. Let us be blunt. If Lincoln had taken the full position of equal and social, of equal social and political rights, he would not have been elected to any statewide office in Illinois, neither in 1854, when he made his first attempt to become senator, and nearly won, nor in 1858, his second, when he and Douglas had their memorable debates. He also didn't get the seat then. He would not have become president in 1860, nor would any member of his party who might take up the banner of full social and political equality. He accomplished the good that he could, always insisting on the fundamental principles that, in the fullness of time, would yield more perfect results. His actions were those of a prudent physician. The patient was not ready for a regimen of bodybuilding until it had recovered somewhat from its deadly disease. That would come later. First life, then strength. Words, words, words. Mere words, men say. And yet it is by the power of words that we take common counsel and learn to govern ourselves. We are free because we are made in the image of the all-wise God, and we have a bit of his light in our minds, and by that bit, we strive to live according to his laws, the laws of nature, and of nature's God. Of divine things, St. Paul writes, but how are men to call upon him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without a preacher? Lincoln preached in Peoria. He preached the political religion he had declared must be preached many years ago in Springfield. That's the Lyceum speech. Douglas and I'll be interspersing quotes here. I'll try to show it with my tone of voice. Douglas and the doctrine of popular sovereignty were giving up the old faith. Human equality and popular sovereignty were as opposite as God and mammon. Three times he calls the proposition that all men are created equal the ancient faith. Of the Nebraska Bill, he says, it hath no relish of salvation in it. He calls the founders our revolutionary fathers and the fathers of the Republic, stirring memories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He compares slavery to the fateful disobedience of Adam. He says, our Republican robe is soiled and trailed in the dust. Let us repurify it. Let us turn and wash it white in the spirit, if not the blood, of the revolution. Lincoln was like a great preacher in more than his scriptural language and his vision that the American Republic was founded on the Declaration as a kind of covenant or original creed, the ancient faith. He endeavored to emulate the charity of great preaching, too, as when he admitted that the Southern people were just what we would be in their situation, and when he said that I surely will not blame them. He stressed that Thomas Jefferson, one of the fathers of the American covenant, was a Virginian by birth, a slaveholder. He opened his speech by announcing that he did not propose to question the patriotism or to assail the motives of any man or class of men. He added that he wished to be no less than national in all the positions he would take. When he had suggested that a gradual emancipation might be adopted, he immediately added, but for their tardiness in this, I will not undertake to judge our brethren of the South. Thus, to political faith, he added political charity. The climax of the speech begins with, our Republican robe is soiled. It ends with these words of salvation and hope, which we quote in full. Let us readopt the Declaration of Independence, and with it the practices and policy which harmonize with it. Let North and South, let all Americans, let all lovers of liberty everywhere join in the great and good work. If we do this, we shall not only have saved the Union, but we shall have so saved it as to make and keep it forever worthy of the saving. We shall have so saved it that succeeding millions of free and happy people the world over shall rise up and call us blessed to the last generation. Now I need to take a breath before I can do this. There is such a thing as good rhetoric. It demands justice on the part of the rhetorician. If he is a political rhetorician, it demands, it requires knowledge of political justice. You heard this before. It aims at healing the body politic, at least where that body is seriously ill. The answer to the question, who were you, Lincoln? What was your art and its power? Could be, I was an American statesman. I had the skill of a Republican rhetorician. My call was to heal the American Republic. And I answered that.